Hey everybody, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Andrew.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Ben. Happy New Year, Graham.
Happy New Year, Ben.
Happy New Year, Mike.
Mike.
Mike. Oh no, where's Mike? What are we going to do?
Poor old Mike.
So Mike's at the dentist, apparently, in Germany, getting his teeth pulled out by a German dentist. Which will serves him right, really. If any kids are listening, you know, you just got to eat less sweets, don't put sugar in your tea, stay off the methadone. All of these things will just rot your teeth, and then you're just building up a world of pain and expense for further on in the future. So quite frankly, it's Mike's own silly fault that he's not here. This is the Linux Voice Podcast, Series 3, Episode 1, and I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Ben Everard. What did we say we'd do it in?
well, that went okay.
So, as you can tell, we're all ticking, firing on all cylinders, ready for the new year, for 2015. And in that vein, we've got a big bunch of news to come. We've got a halfway reminder. We've got Finds of the Fortnite. We may or may not have some neurons. It depends whether Mike in his pain-ravaged state managed to send any over to us. And we've got Voice of the Masses. And if you like that sort of thing, but bound up into a paper, or indeed an electronic form, then you can buy Linux Voice, the magazine, which is, you know, really great. Yeah, and that's at shop.linuxvoice.com. So, is there anything else that we usually cover in the introduction?
I think that's it.
I'll press on with news then. First up, GNOME is now the most popular desktop on Arch Linux. According to a recent usage survey, at least, announced on, I think it was archlinux.de. And they've got first place was 30.4% of the user base. Second up with KDE was with 30.06. So GNOME only just edges out KDE to get the top spot there. And third place was XFCE with 24%. In fourth place was Cinnamon with 9.8, then LXDE with 9.5, Mate with 7.83, and the lowest one they had a score for was Enlightenment with 4.8% of the desktop.
Really, we're talking about a GNOME XFCE coalition then, with no clear overall majority.
But yeah. GNOME tells XFCE what to do, and XFCE apologises for it.
And either way, the students are screwed.
I'm that really surprised. Surprised me.
I'd have thought that KDE by a million miles would be Arch Linux users' favourite distro.
Well,
but that's only because I'm going from a sample size of one, and that's Graham.
I'd have thought they'd go for something like Xmonad or something like that. I'm surprised KDE's so high. I'd have thought that KDE would, you know, okay, I can understand them going for GNOME, but KDE doesn't seem to fit in with the Arch mentality or the picture of Arch users I've got in my head.
Well, because KDE is not configurable enough.
I don't know. It's like, it'd be interesting to compare those results to Gen 2.
fine. they also had sort of the statistics for applications in other categories. So we've now got this picture of the average Arch user. I can tell you that they use Firefox to browse the web, Nano for text editing, and obviously GNOME desktop environment. Thunar, oddly enough, is their file manager. VLC for music or videos. Bash for the shell. And then NVIDIA graphics driver.
Do you think Manjaro results are included in this, or anything like that?
That's a good question. I don't know. I had assumed it was just pure Arch, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, mind you, I am surprised that there's not more. I mean, I run KDE, but I have to start it manually because I never bothered putting a login manager on there. Quite interestingly, the latest packages for KDE 5. Now work alongside KDE Base 4, so I can now use both KDE 4 and KDE 5 apps, which is really good. that makes my system usable again. And in fact, while I couldn't use KDE4 apps with KDE5, I removed KDE4 and used GNOME. So I wonder if that's skewed the results at all.
On my Arch install, I do have a login manager, but it doesn't have any working icons. It just has a little red X where all the icons should be. But yeah, that's got both Mate and i3 installed. So next up on the news, Intel Compute Sticks are announced. These are, they sort of look like USB memory sticks, but they're not. They're HDMI computers that you sort of plug into your HDMI port. They're like similar to the Chromecast, and I think there's a Fire Stick, is there, by Amazon? And there's loads of sort of generic Android HDMI sticks. But as far as I'm aware, these are the first x86 ones. They'll come with a quad-core Atom processor. The official announcement from Intel didn't have too many details, but there's some rumours around about the specs. And that's that the Windows version will come with 32 gig of storage, 2 gig of RAM, and for $149. The Linux version will come with 1 gig of RAM, 8 gig of storage for $89. I'm a little bit bemused by these, to be honest, because the HDMI sticks that you can get, the Android ones and the ARM ones, are all used for media players. And it's hard to see the advantage of a quad-core Atom there. I've never used one of these sticks, but I've never had any issues with an ARM-based media player.
No, having played with XBMC Kodi a lot over the last few weeks, you know, it works well on the Raspberry Pi, it has to be said, but the more power you can throw at it, the more RAM and the more powerful a CPU you can throw at it, the better it operates. So I'd be really excited to try Kodi on one of those things. Maybe it's the same for the Windows Media Player. I don't know. Maybe that's just what they're designed for.
Yeah, it's true. And at $89, the low-end Linux one, that is comparable to the price of the higher-end ARM sticks. The Chromecast and whatnot are still quite a lot cheaper.
And I think, but the Chromecast, I think, isn't powerful enough to run XBMC with any decent performance.
Yeah, I mean, the only ones I've run XBMC on are the Raspberry Pi and the Freescale IMX6 processors, and they do usually come in at around the same price. But it'll be interesting to try them out. But
yeah, see if we can get hold of one.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah. Next up on the news, GNOME Builder IDE, a new IDE for the GNOME Shell, has just passed its target on its crowdfunding target. We're looking to raise £30,000 to create this wonderful new GTK IDE. And it took 11 days, they got the money, and it's going ahead. This is by a guy called Christian Hergert. I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly. Apologies, Christian, if I haven't.
That's awesome. 30 grand in 11 days. Respect.
Yeah, I really struggle to get excited by this purely because I've never been a fan of IDEs. I've always preferred just to code in a text editor.
That's because you're a real man, Ben.
I have to use IDEs because I can never remember the syntax for any single statement. So I need it all highlighted and finished off for me. And I need to right click on something and click F1 to see what the docs are.
So we can extrapolate from that then that an IDE, if you've got a good idea but aren't that great a coder, an IDE will help you to make it flesh, which is exactly what you know GNOME needs.
It's been a long time since I've used them, but I've always found that because the main advantage usually is the drag and drop graphical desktop builder, graphical interface builder. And I just find the code that they produce is so messy that I don't know, maybe I'm just not very good at using IDEs. Maybe that's the problem. But yeah, as I say, I've always preferred to build mine up manually. I don't need to remember syntax because I cut and paste all my code from Stack Overflow.
Well, the GUI designer in Qt Creator and KDevelop, I think they're pretty woeful as well. I mean, they're improving a lot, especially with QML making it kind of a necessity if if you're not a coder to be able to build GUIs. But yeah, I still, also the whole CMake thing or the whole build system becomes so complicated. It's an IDE usually does a much better job at managing dependencies on files than I can manually. But
yeah, it's been a long time since I've done a project big enough to have complex make files, to be honest. So yeah.
But I mean, GNOME hasn't, was it Glade, or it's been a long time since it's been like a modern IDE for GNOME.
Yeah, that's true. And it does seem that at the moment, Qt has a much better sort of mind share in terms of new developers and new environments and stuff. Well, and part of that could well be that it's got a better tool set and something like this will help.
Well, I mean,
GTK.
It's a different ecosystem, and it always has been. There are, you know, there are hundreds of paid developers working on Qt. You know, it's a business. It's a different thing to GNOME developers creating their own IDE. Although you could probably say Eclipse fits into that if you needed to, which I find horrendously complicated whenever I have to load up Eclipse, which is usually to do something with Android.
There's a new one for Android, isn't there now? Is it the IDEA?
Or? Yeah, there is. IntelliJ IDEA. It's based on that, I think. That's the open source bot. And the tutorials that we did in Linux Voice on, I think I did two or three of them on Android development. That was really good.
Yeah, I've used Eclipse a few times. And I think it is one of those things that if you use it every day and you learn how it all works and, I don't know, you can probably set up the shortcuts for you or whatever, it's probably really powerful. But unless you use it every day, I don't know, it confuses my tiny mind anyway. So the final item on the news this fortnight is Tizen phones. So long rumoured, so many times they've been announced, they've actually been released. The Samsung Z1 is now for sale in India. It's a relatively low-end phone. It's 4-inch screen, 1.2 gigahertz dual-core processor, 768 megabytes of RAM, 4 gig of storage. So By modern smartphone standards, it's fairly low end, but for $90, that's a reasonable price for it. Samsung are touting the lightweightness of the Tizen platform. Yeah, they're saying it's fast, it's, you know, web apps work well, they're saying the battery lasts a long time. We haven't been able to get one, so I haven't actually been able to test whether or not these claims are true.
You just reminded me, actually, from one of the announcements at CES, was that Samsung smart TVs in 2015 are going to run Tizen.
I've actually just recently converted my TV to run Android using an external ARM board.
Oh, really? Oh.
And using the UDO. It works really well. We've got a wireless mouse. I can show you, but not the listeners.
A mouse on the television.
That's a nice mouse.
Yeah. Well, it actually works quite well because we've got a coffee table just in front of the sofa.
Yeah.
And just sit the mouse on that, and it's a little bit annoying because for some reason 4OD just won't work. We've got an Amazon Prime account, but the Amazon TV Prime Video thing only works on phones, and the fact that for some reason that the TV identifies itself as a tablet, so it just refuses to start, and there's stuff like that which is just why. Netflix works well, iPlayer works well.
The our television came with a Bluetooth mouse pointer remote, which is quite nice. Yeah. It looks a bit like the top part of it looks like the Steam controller. You know, the where they've replaced the digital pad? So it's like a concave place to put your thumb. And as you move, you drag your thumb around, it drags the cursor around. So it feels more like a remote control. You hand it in your hand, but you can cursor around. I don't actually use it, but it sounds a bit better than having a mouse in the living room.
You say that. I find the mouse easier to use than most remotes, because when remotes get complicated and you've got buttons and scroll pads like that, I'm just so used to using a mouse that it just works. And you can use it on your legs or whatever.
You use the mouse to tell your legs which way to point?
No, you use your legs as the base to scroll the mouse on.
whatever, hey, that's fine.
I have no idea how well Titan will work, but Android works quite well, at least for me. So that's all the news we have this fortnight.
Thanks, Ben. So it's now... it's been almost a month, but it's been a very quiet month, hasn't it, really, in terms of Linux news, for finds and things like that. So it's now time for finds of the fortnight. One thing that I was... we just briefly discussed it, but Ubuntu Canonical is going to release its phone soon. And at Linux Voice, we're hopefully going to be getting one in early February. And those of us lucky enough to be getting them are getting emails from Canonical as they it feels a little bit like hyping up their product launch, but you know, they're allowed to. They're trying to do something really ambitious.
It's a big deal.
Yeah. And in their latest kind of insider's press release, what is genuinely interesting is that I'll read their paragraph. Key mobile services in iOS and Android are delivered via apps in a fragmented manner and controlled by platform owners such as Google, Apple and Microsoft, which has put OEMs and operators into a secondary role. So from that, it sounds like they're going to want to empower developers to publish their own apps without going through an app store. But what it actually says in the following paragraph is, with the Ubuntu phone, we are moving away from the app grid towards integrated content and services, and we do this by providing a user experience that is centered on bringing the Key Mobile digital life services directly to screen, which at heart we call Scopes.
Wait, I haven't used Ubuntu Touch for a long time, but I used an early version, and there it was, the Scopes were a little bit like... you know, on Android, you can scroll to the side and you get a separate set of icons and you can have, I know, four or five of these. And you can put your widgets on. It was a bit like a souped-up version of that. So you scrolled one way and you had, like, a music player. You scrolled again and you had, like, a video player. I don't know if they're still doing it that way, but at the time I used it, it was clear that it just wasn't finished yet. But it looked really good. It looked like there was definitely... If they did it well, it looked like it could be really good.
I'm quite excited about it, and looking forward to trying it. It will be good to have a different kind of phone ecosystem, and one, you know, funded by Canonical. I'm looking forward to it.
I do wonder if they're just too late though now. You know, we've got Selfish, we've got Samsung, we've now got Tizen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they're going to have to get the geeks, because the geeks are the only people who are going to buy something like this, first of all. And then maybe after a year, if it's got an ecosystem, if it becomes popular, regular people start buying it. And are the geeks now a bit bored of new Linux-powered phones? I don't know.
I don't know why you wouldn't choose Android. Because, you know, Android basically can be put on a phone for free, and it's got such a huge app store and ecosystem, and everybody knows it now. It's very difficult to compete with. Having said that, I think the key to their success, Canonical's success, is going to be OEM deals that they can make and people and give them a good reason to do it. Then maybe it'll work. Maybe in a similar way to Firefox OS has found a niche.
I don't know if this is still their plan, but with the Ubuntu Edge, it looked like they were going the other way, trying to drop into the high end and say, you know, to differentiate, oh, you're not just another chump with Android, you're better than them.
I don't see how that's going to lead to like huge amounts of sales. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if the $20 million or whatever they got was everybody who was interested in one, or you know, a significant proportion of who'd be interested in one. It's not the huge smartphone markets that Samsung enjoys or whoever. Okay, well, I'll move on. I also asked our IRC channel just as we started recording for finds, and we've had a few. I haven't read them before because we... literally started as I asked. P. Waring, he's already told me how to pronounce that, and I think I've forgotten. He's quite rightly points out that Cadbury's cream eggs are now no longer made out of Dairy Milk chocolate, which is a travesty.
What are they made out of?
I think they're made out of some generic cocoa solid stuff. So this is something that only UK people will understand, or people from the UK, but Cadbury's cream eggs are things that you can, there's small things that you can buy at Easter that are like a chocolate egg with a kind of a white fondant in the middle. And the chocolate was made out of Dairy Milk, which is Cadbury's kind of main brand of chocolate. And Cadbury's, I think, was bought by Kraft, wasn't it, a couple of years ago?
Yes, it was.
By a big US company. So this is purely a result of US corporate interests diminishing our cultural heritage.
It's not that they're made out of exactly the same stuff, but now the EU says it can't be called chocolate.
No, it can't be that. So Devilments followed that find up with my find of the fortnight is cheese on toast with a layer of Marmite on the bread before the cheese.
Oh, I can't stand Marmite.
No, I'm not a huge Marmite fan either. Although I quite like Twiglets, which I don't think goes...
I do as well.
Related find, cheese on toast with a layer of mayonnaise and mustard. Well, mustard and cheese goes quite well. Okay, so this is a... Nanu Phoenix, I love cheese on toast with a layer of whole grain mustard and tomato puree. I'll have to try another mayonnaise, though. My foodie-related find of the fortnight is to throw some cinnamon stick in the grinder when grinding coffee beans. Makes for a lovely cuppa.
Oh, yeah. Hello.
In Tanzania, the standard spice to have with coffee is ginger, and it's really nice. A ginger coffee. I think that's quite common in sort of the Arabic world in general.
I have to try that.
But yeah, just get back to the cheese on toast. Yeah, if you're putting tomato and then cheese, at what point does it just become a pizza?
Well, that's a pizza is just pretentious cheese on toast.
And okay, we have a proper fine from Still Void, who says
oh, hooray!
not much mail.org. It's a thing for tagging your email and then being able to search for it very easily. It deals with vast quantities of email quite happily. Another actual find from Still Void, thanks Still Void, is FASD, github.com/clvv/FASD. It remembers where you've been in your file system and then allows you to jump to locations easily. Typing ZLV would drop me straight into Home Steve Documents LV if I've been there recently. That sounds great. Akido Kajef says his find is MHDDFS. Join multiple file systems to form a single large file system. That sounds excellent. Not used it properly yet. Sorry, Ben.
So is it like a fused file system that takes a few others and...
Without clicking on the link or knowing any more than that, that sounds like it would be what it does. Yeah, so different file system types into a single file system. Especially the option of moving data around if it's low on space disk, low on disk space. Yes. Just skipping through, that's pretty much it. There's a discussion about RAID, and then Still Void generously says Linux Voice on IRC is a good source of finds. Shall I follow that up? I've got an audio related find, and that's the release of an FM synthesizer emulator called DexZ, a brand new version. And there's a Linux version, which is obviously the most important thing. FM synthesis was huge in the 80s with Yamaha kind of, in fact, pushed out all the analog synthesizers that came before it and showed that digital synthesis and chips were the way forward by providing lots of multi-timbral sounds and polyphony. And so DexZ is a DX7 synth emulator, the DX7 being that Yamaha synth from the mid-80s that changed all that. And it's actually a very lovely sound. Old sound cards, like in the 1990s, used to have an FM synth on board because they became so cheap to produce. And it creates a very distinctive sound. And it's great to have a proper recreation of the old synth. So
is FM synth the same as pulse-coded modulation?
No, PCM is usually... sounds based on samples. So in the old days, PCM would be the attack sound of the attack part of a sound. A sample would be the attack because that's difficult to synthesize.
I'm just thinking in terms of what frequency modulation... It is frequency modulation, isn't it, FM?
Yeah, it is.
So it doesn't mean something different.
Well, it's actually quite... It's horrendously complex in the end result, but... The input is straightforward. It's basically sine waves modulating other sine waves. So that's the frequency modulation. So you have a sine wave at a certain frequency, and then you modulate that. But the clever part is that you have the signal and you have a carrier, but you have a multiplicity of sine waves and carriers and signals all cross-modulating one another and all feeding back into one another, which does create a very distinctive, quite harmonic sound. Very good for brassy sounds and stuff like that. I might have to cut all this. Anyway, that's my find. That's my find. I haven't tried it yet, but it'd be great if it loaded up DX7 patches from the 80s because they still sound great. Anyone else?
Yes, I've got a discovery. It came in the post just before Christmas, and it's the CamJam Educate 2 sensors. So I'm going to hold stuff up in front of the webcam and see if you can identify them. Right, there's this thing. It looks like one of the golf balls at Firingdale's.
That's a passive infrared sensor, a PIR.
Right.
Vibration detector.
Good work. And this thing looks a wee bit like a condenser microphone.
That's a temperature sensor.
Ah, Ben's good. Big bunch of leads. That's a big bunch of leads I've given that away. What's this? What's that?
That's a capacitor.
And this thing here.
That's a light-dependent resistor, I believe.
So there's temperature, infrared, light. That's a buzzer. Well, I recognise that.
The infrared one doesn't actually give you an infrared readout. It just lets you know if anything's changed in the infrared picture.
Oh, so sort of like as a motion detector thing then.
Exactly, yeah. There's three pins on it. There's a positive and negative, and there's a signal pin, which will just work like a button, really. It just goes on and off, depending on whether or not there's any motion.
Right. There's this, which is obviously the breadboard. Even I can recognise that. And then these resistors here. Let's have a resistor colour band challenge.
Oh, it's been ages since I've done resistor colour bands. That, I believe, is a 330 ohm.
Respect. Well, good work.
Two 330 ohm resistors, in fact.
And what's this?
Oh, I don't know.
It's a bit fuzzy, so I'll let you off.
Yeah.
Anyway, so all that stuff as described for the bargain price of, can you just have a quick guess?
Like, £15.
£20. Higher, pounds. Lower, £7.
£7.
That's insanity. And the best.
That's really good, actually. Yeah.
And the best thing is, I mean, obviously the hardware, you know, there's plenty of stuff to play with here, but the best thing is, and I said it about the first CamJam EduKit. The best thing is the documentation, the little tutorials that Mike and Tim have written are just superb. They're just so clear and easy to follow. And even if you've got no experience of programming with GPIOs on a Raspberry Pi, because that's what this kit is all meant for. It's stuff to add onto your Raspberry Pi. You'll pick it up in no time, and it's. You know, there's a good few hours. You know, there's a couple of afternoons of just messing about with LEDs and sensors and stuff there for £7. That's such an absolute bargain, and it opens up just a world of other things, of robots and, you know, stuff. Yeah. So that's my discovery, and I think that's a pretty good discovery. I'm pleased with that.
That's excellent.
So that brings me on to my discoveries then, I guess. First discovery, I've been getting some pain in my hand from using the mouse too much. I think that's quite common amongst people who use computers a lot. And I was sort of looking to things I can do, and I tried various things, but I came across a vertical mouse. And it's a regular mouse, but sort of rotated 90 degrees. So instead of holding your hand flat, you hold your hand vertically. And the buttons are on the side, and you can the sensor's still on the bottom, so you can move it about. And it's pretty much a regular mouse, but just molded into a different shape. And mine only arrived yesterday, so I haven't had that much experience with it. But straight away, it just felt so much more comfortable to use. It's just a much more natural way of holding your hand, and you rest your arm on the desk, so you're not sort of holding it all up. And it's just I didn't have any problems at all yesterday, and there's usually a little bit in there at the end of the day. So the preliminary feeling is it's really good. The only slight things are it's a little bit hard to use the scroll wheel on it. That's not very natural. And it takes slightly longer to switch from the keyboard to the mouse, but that might just be getting used to the different position. So I'll let you know again next podcast, but so far that feels really good.
How does it actually work?
It's exactly the same as a regular mouse. It's a little bit hard to describe. But we can put an image to them in the podcast notes and you'll see away from an image. But it's just the shape of the mouse is that it's upright rather than on its side. So you've got that. It's almost like a joystick-like position, but you move it around in the same way.
Okay.
It's not
okay.
Like a trackerball or
right.
anything.
Right.
And this my second discovery is I use a free VPN service to make it look as though I'm appearing from different countries when I want to bypass geographical restrictions and that sort of thing. Because geographical restrictions are ridiculous. And one of them tried to man in the middle me the other day.
Oh.
I got a SSL error message and I was like, that's not right. So I sort of dove into it a bit. And the fake SSL certificate was being generated by an Avast antivirus product. Obviously not on my computer, I don't run Avast. So this VPN was using Avast to man in the middle people's SSL connections. And that is just be careful. If you're not paying for a VPN, then they're trying to make money out of you some way. But it really shocked me that was the tool they used as well. And it did make me wonder, actually, I've no way of checking this, but if you had Avast running on the computer you were connecting through the VPN with, would that have still given an SSL error or would it have just let it through?
So that would give whoever was running the VPN access to any of the data that you thought was encrypted.
Exactly, yeah. They'd have been able to watch the Netflix stream alongside me.
Or, you know, bank details if that's what you happen to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. It would get complete access to everything. Yeah. Maybe it's David Cameron running it.
We'll come on to David Cameron later.
Well, they're pretty much our finds anyway, aren't they? Which is good.
Yes, they are. They're our finds, not our discoveries. Sorry, Graham.
I think we should give it up with the whole finds thing. Discoveries is so much easier to say. It's just burnt into that part of our brain before alcohol, you know, killed all the updated cells.
Is it going to be a thing there? If we say we use the words discovery, we'll just constantly say finds.
Finds. Discoveries, finds, yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Let's find out.
Or let's discover.
Well, that seems to bring us onto the halfway reminder, as we're roughly 80% of the way through the podcast. We'll still to come. We may or may not have neurons to vocalise from Mike, if he sent any before he went to the marathon man ordeal of having his teeth pulled out. And we've also got Voice of the Masses. So, neurons. Any neurons? So, it's time now for Voice of the Masses. Following the UK Prime Minister David Cameron's suggestion that end-to-end encryption should be banned, we're asking... we're asking, how can we educate politicians? You know, they make laws on things that they don't necessarily know everything about. And that's only natural because, you know, we're not... No one expects anyone to know everything about everything. So how can we manage upwards? You know, how can we make sure that the people who are making these laws are slightly better informed than they are at the moment? I mean, David Cameron asked a rhetorical question. In our country, do we want to allow a means of communication between people that we cannot read, we being the authorities? And I would have thought the obvious answer would be yes, of course we do, because... Yeah. just because
there's a sound for that somewhere, isn't there?
It's like, So, for our first podcast of the year, tell us what you think. How can we educate our politicians about the importance of privacy on the internet? Should all PPE degrees include a module on how the internet works? Or do we need a completely new party that includes prospective MPs who actually understand the net and how encryption is vital to its future? Let us know your comments below. So, before we get on to real people's comments, Graham, what do you think? How can we ensure that our ruling class is slightly more clued up about this vital thing that we call the internet?
The answer to that specific question is too huge and too deep, I think, to be... It's their fear that people can communicate without agencies being able to intercept that I really dislike. It's the fear part that I don't like. There's been a kind of a transformation, or maybe I was too young, and maybe it's always been the same. But the fact that the government should be and are representatives looking out for what I think should be our best interests, it's somehow changed to be looking out for their own interests, and so surveillance and opening up secure emails is really just in their best interest to make what they think is their jobs easier, when it won't make their jobs easier. And that's only as far as they can see it. As to the problem as why people like David Cameron say such misguided things, that is such a big question. I don't know if I can even answer it.
All right, well, Ben, we'll come back to you in a sec. But first of all, let's hear from the internet and the Linux Voice listeners and readers. Moylan says, dispel the "if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear" myth would be number one on my to-do list. Jan, why not vote for an educated person for a change? Educating those in charge is hopeless, I'm afraid. John says, decrypt Cameron's private communications and publish them. Okay. Nano suggests mandatory lobotomies for anyone in power who suggests outlawing encryption. It's the only way. Craig says, I don't blame Cameron, really. This is expected behaviour. However, I do blame whoever is supposed to be advising him on all things technology. Anyone with an ounce of common sense knows banning encryption like this is not practical. And then there's a little reply to that from Hugh, who says, you've got it the wrong way around. I'm sure that there are all sorts of people in the tech industry screaming at Cameron that this is a bad idea, but historically our governments have a very poor track record of listening to experts. Ben, you used to be an expert, didn't you?
Once upon a time, but I've forgotten it all now.
So did you find that that you were just a bit stupid and gave bad advice to people, or was it more that people were not inclined to listen to your advice?
Well, the thing you've got to realise is a lot of the people who are giving advice to the government are the people who would potentially be asked to implement it. So you've got the Accentures, the Capgeminis, etc., etc., the big consultants of the world. And to them, they can think this is monumentally stupid, but it's a millions of pounds of contracts in there to implement it.
Ah.
That's very cynical, then.
So, it's also completely true.
Oh no! I need a dose of John Roberts now to
come on to pick
me up.
You know, it doesn't matter how bad. I mean, to be honest, when you'd hear governments talking about just bad ideas for projects, you did just think that is, you know, those specifications just don't match up. So you can spend twice as long implementing something that doesn't match up and say, well, it was your specifications, then they have to pay you millions more to rearrange it into something that does actually work. That is just the way government IT services work.
Wow. Thanks, Ben. Cynical Sod says, I don't think education comes into it much. Politicians, Cameron's ilk in particular, will use unfortunate world events to push through with their agenda in blissful ignorance of the ramifications on the lives of us normal folk. It's possible that a more tech-savvy generation of politicians wouldn't be willing to so readily expose their tech ignorance as to suggest doing away with encryption. However, they will do what serves the government's interest first. a generation thing. So if we, that implies that if we just wait for a few years, then politicians will, no, will just, see, update themselves.
I think they're willingly ignorant. I think, you know, it's like Ben was saying, and like I was trying to say, this is what they do. You know, they don't have to be morally right. That's not what they're trying to do. What they're trying to do is ensure their own power in their system.
I think it goes, it's not necessarily just politicians in this case, because, you know, I mentioned about the contracts as well, but when this first happened, presumably David Cameron or his, you know, his Hollande, the French prime minister, would have gotten to the phone to the intelligence services and said, why didn't you tell us, why didn't you warn us this was going to happen? Why did you let this person get through?
Yeah.
And this person's being attacked. They need to defend themselves. They're going to say, well, it's not my fault, Governor. You wouldn't let me spy on them. Or
they've said, well, they've been talking to one another, but we can't read what they're saying to one another because it's end-to-end encrypted.
Exactly. And that's the natural response you would expect from the head of a spy agency who's just missed a terrorist attack.
Yes, it is.
It's not my fault. It's someone else's fault. And the job of a politician is to balance up, to understand what they say. They're saying, oh, this is it. And then it seems to me that there's no one counteracting that voice, no high-level lobby group saying, actually, that guy's a bit of an idiot. That's a stupid idea. Because all the people at the highest level, the contractors who could implement it, the government, the spy agencies, the intelligence, they all have the same motivation, and that is to increase power and money for themselves. And for all of those people, even if the politician is completely impartial, all the people advising him have a material benefit in increasing surveillance. So what you need, the only solution is to counteract that. You need a high-level, powerful lobby group, effectively, that has a motivation to decrease surveillance.
Yeah.
And, you know, that could be the Pirate Party, that could be the FSFE, that could be the EFF. But those are all small groups. They're tiny groups compared to Westminster power levels. And in my mind, there's only one group of people that could really oppose us and should be really opposing this at the highest level. And that is the unions, the people representing particularly the public workers. And I don't think this has ever really been picked up on. And I think it's something they should be really aware of. They're often in direct confrontation with the government over pay, conditions, etc., etc. And imagine the consequences to them if the government had access to every single one of their communications, both public and private. Yeah. Every single member of a public service union having their communication tapped. That's what we're talking about. And they should be outraged at this. Knowing the exact power situation within a strike, knowing exactly who they needed to target just to make strikes disappear. The unions should be absolutely furious about this. And I don't know if you're hearing this because my computer screen's just turned off.
Yeah, we can see you as well. You look angry.
But those are the people I really feel let down. I think David Cameron's
That's a shame. We've lost him. He can't hear us.
He's waving his hands. He's waving his hands.
He looks a bit like Scargill.
He's still talking.
He's still talking even though no one's listening. Exactly like Scargill. Brilliant. Toey71 says, most of the current crop of politicians are pretty clueless on just about everything because they have very limited experience outside the Westminster bubble. And he says more words, but I think he's pretty much encapsulated it there in one single clause. Let's not forget that David Cameron's only job outside politics was working as a PR person for Carlton Television for, a year or something. Micah Den, the Linux Voice Party sounds quite good, no? Yes, it does. It sounds great. So much stuff. Everyone's kind of in agreement, really, that they're silly people.
What do you think, Andrew?
Well, I have here a piece of paper, which was sent to me about a year ago from 10 Downing Street. Which I'm about to read out. It says, Dear Mr. Gregory, the Prime Minister has asked me to thank you for your email of the 23rd of January, requesting an interview with him for Linux Magazine. we'll gloss over that one. The Prime Minister greatly appreciates you taking the time and trouble to write to him. However, owing to the enormous pressures on his diary, I regret that it will not be possible to arrange an interview. I am sorry for the disappointing nature of my reply, but do hope you can understand. Thank you once again for writing. If they'd said yes to this, to an interview with us, then we could have told them, like, firsthand. We could have looked them in the eye and told them that they were being silly. And this was in response to the last year's folly, the pornography filter that blocked, you know, rape crisis centres and child services things. I don't know. I think maybe you know, a free Raspberry Pi for Eton, Westminster, and Holland Park would be a good start to, you know, because they're clearly suffering with a lack of resources when it comes to computing. And that's where our leaders come from. Yeah, the PPE suggestion wasn't all that facetious, actually. I can't remember, who was it who said? Aeon Rudd says, quotes us with the, should all PPE degrees include a module on how the internet works? Says, presumably that's a facetious question, but it does point to how problematic uniformity in politics is. As it becomes professionalised, the political class become more detached from the rest of society in every area. But saying that politicians should have knowledge of a particular area, as many sectors of society do, just feeds that uniformity. In fact, it contributes to the minority capture of politics. Far more effective is ensuring politics actually reflects a diversity of knowledge. That's more or less Toey's point, and I quite agree with the both of them.
So we've got a general election this year. As far as I could see, it was actually only Nick Clegg who said it was a stupid idea. So he's the leader of the Liberal Democrat Party.
Labour have said it's stupid as well, haven't they? One of the various Miliband's saying that.
That's cool. You know what we should do? We should get in touch with each of the five major parties in the United Kingdom. Ask them what their stances are on a series of five set questions that we give to all of them equally, and write up the results in some sort of pre-election feature that we print in Linux Voice.
Propaganda.
Honest and fair and balanced reporting.
Hang on, five major parties. So you're not including Al Murray as the pub landlord?
That's not a party, is it? That's an independent candidate.
I think you've got to include Al Murray and not UKIP.
Al Murray's sold more DVDs than UKIP.
It's a good point, actually. I've never seen a good breakdown of the opinions of the various parties as they with regards to major tech policies.
No, I've only got fragments. Like before the 2010 election, David Cameron highlighted Firefox as an example of the quote-unquote big society. What else? The Lib Dems opposed that some bill or other about... I can't even remember that. Yeah. Some sort of research is required. We should do that.
Yeah, I think that'd be good. Yeah. That's quite a positive call to action for the end of the podcast.
That's a great. We should end on a note of positivity. So, wishes of luck then, listeners and readers. We're off to do some work, and the Hobbit Battle of the Five Armies is showing at 2:20. So I'm going to go and see that after lunch.
Good idea.
I saw it on Monday.
Is it good?
It is.
Yeah,
good.
It's good.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.